Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the Court, Santino Tricotti, on behalf of the appellant, Ramon Sanabria. Over defense counsel's continued objections, the trial court allowed the prosecutor to circumvent the rules of evidence, which resulted in an improper conviction for my client. Officer Garcia, from looking at the record, was permitted to provide gratuitous statements of specific criminal assertions that met the element of the crime of burglary here, which the jury would understand as meeting the element. There were three instances where Garcia went on describing what took place at the scene. Now, this court has held and found that background history of why a police officer is at a scene or doing what he is doing is the best practice is to simply limit it to that he received background information. Now, certainly that's maybe idealistic in some cases, and in some cases there is a need for background information. The state's contention is precisely this, is that he should be allowed to provide why it is he is at the scene. The problem is, by the time the third hearsay statement makes it in about motion sensors going off in the foyer area of the home, there's already been plenty of background information of why Officer Garcia is there. For example, the first time that there's an objection, he's told, what information did you have upon dispatch? The answer, he says, is I was advised that a neighbor had seen a Hispanic male, which meets the description of the defendant, walking through her yard to the rear of the house. This objection is overruled, and it goes on a second time to explain another reason why he's there is because the alarm company had called the 911 dispatcher to explain that the motion alarms were going off. So, in essence, it's superfluous to provide additional information of why the officer is at the scene and checking the doors.
Let's assume that your position prevails and there's another trial. And you've mentioned three hearsay statements. At the next trial, what's your position with regard to the admissibility of the first two statements, the content of those statements?
Well, if we take the court's previous position on this issue, we know that the best practice is to say that the officer arrived upon information received. Now, to answer Your Honor's question, these two hearsay statements do go above and beyond that.
All right, well, let's take them one at a time. The first one says there was a call from a neighbor about a person going through the yard. I take it from your answer, your position would be, I responded to this address because I was directed there by the dispatcher to investigate suspicious activity.
Absolutely.
And that would be a similar answer when the alarm people called in.
Yes. Yes, and the reason the state cites Johnson and the defense cites Johnson, and Johnson provides parameters to review in this type of situation. And in most of the time when the hearsay comes in for a non-hearsay purpose, it's usually if the officer's conduct is in question, whether someone has questioned the arbitrariness of it or whether the procedures are in question. But in this situation, I'm sorry.
I understood your answer. And I wanted to move to the third hearsay comment, and as I understand that, your position is the real problem is the substantive nature of having someone inside the house if the motion detector in the foyer had been activated. And what the error that you attribute to the trial judge here is, even if you assume background is otherwise permissible, you still have to balance the prejudice. And since the content of this hearsay was an element of the offense, it was too prejudicial to be admitted.
Exactly. And in other way, it's a 403 balancing test. I think the state's position, the blanket statement that out-of-court statements offered to show why an officer acted the way he or she did, is not correct. And the case law from this court is clear to the effect that that's, when that question is answered, the inquiry does not stop. We have to see how prejudicial it is, because this, in cases, the need for the evidence is light. But the likelihood for misusing the evidence is really the problem. Secondly, with respect to harm, the harm is pretty straightforward here. The case was circumstantial. The problem with the statements that were elicited from Officer Garcia is that they meet an element of burglary. They put, by saying that motion sensors went off in the foyer area while the defendant is on the scene, is giving the jury the inference that he's in the home. That meets the element for the jury. There's no, and the record is devoid of any other evidence, circumstantial or direct, that puts him in the home.
Am I correct that there was some fingerprint evidence, but the police lost the fingerprint evidence?
They did, and for that reason, they're to be found exculpatory of the defendant.
And was a lolly instruction given to the jury in this case?
With respect to the fingerprints? Yes, I believe it was. And going on, not to go back to the first issue with respect to the officer, but it's important to note that a jury instruction, a limiting instruction, was not given with respect to the use of the hearsay statements. The state's position was, we're using to show why the officer conducted what he did at the scene. There was no limiting instruction on that.
Is there an indication that one was requested?
No, it was not. But I think it goes to harm as to what the jury inferred from those statements. Throughout the record, there's the state asserts that there's circumstantial evidence enough that meets the element of the crime here. But if one looks at the record closely, nothing is as extraordinary as the statement of the motion sensors going off in the house.
Is there a distinct argument between your concern for the hearsay and the confrontation clause? Are those
defense would
so
view
consistent
them,
that they're the same argument?
Yes, and for the reason that they serve the same values. Defense counsel cannot effectively represent his client if the lone evidence of putting the defendant in the home for the crime cannot be cross-examined by the dispatcher of the alarm company who's not a trial to be cross-examined. That's how it comes in. And that's precisely why it's so prejudicial here.
Is it your position that the statement about the sensors going on, which arguably by circumstantial evidence placed the defendant in the home meeting the test for an element for burglary, it's your view that can't be cured by an argument that it wasn't offered for its truth. It was just offered to help explain why the police officer was there.
Yes, for the reason that Justice Holland pointed out, earlier, which is you, there's a balancing test here. If we don't set a parameter, we could, I mean, the alarm company, Officer Garcia could go on as to what he was told on the phone by the dispatcher.
Well, the reason I'm asking about this is 403 came up, a balancing test came up, but before you get to 403, you have to reach a conclusion about whether it is or is not inadmissible hearsay.
Yes.
And what is our standard of review on the question of whether it's inadmissible hearsay as opposed to whether the trial judge properly applied 403 in a balancing test? Is the standard review the same? That abuse of discretion for both?
I believe the standard review is abuse of discretion under those questions. With respect to getting to 403, it's important to note that the state's position that it's a non-hearsay purpose, the out-of-court statements, they're hearsay. The state is trying to put them into a category of non-hearsay. But they can always assert a non-hearsay purpose. Whether it fits that non-hearsay purpose is the issue here.
So, as I understand your brief, the officer responded based on the call from the dispatcher. And one way to look at his recitation of his conduct is he appeared that he was going to leave, and then he went back to the front door. And the question the state argued that had to be answered for the jury is why. And you submit that could have been resolved by simply saying, I received another call, as opposed to I received a call that the motion detectors in the foyer had been activated.
Correct. And moreover, it's the record is not clear whether the officer was going to leave the premises. What he says is he was checking the front and back door, which I assume is the practice for an officer at a scene after a burglar has been called in or suspicious behavior at a residence. So that's what fits with what the officer is doing.
So to that extent, if he checked one of the doors twice, that was probably not even noteworthy of why he did it. You might expect good police work to involve double checking.
Exactly. And here the problem was that wasn't good enough, so they had to bring in multiple hearsay statements to explain why it is he was doing what he's doing when it probably was the standard course of action regardless.
Were there objections made after each of these hearsay statements was made?
There was for the first and the third. And the reason I think the second, well, I should explain the second. It was a non-responsive answer. The second hearsay statement actually came after a question that was, what did you do when you arrived? And the officer took it upon his own will to back up and say, let me tell you what I was told, and then I'll tell you what I did when I arrived. There was an objection to the first to answer your question and the third. And after the first one, it appeared that the trial court was going to allow the officer to go on with his hearsay.
So there was a hearsay objection aimed at keeping that evidence out?
Yes.
Was there a 403 argument made at that point?
No, not specifically.
Was there a 403 argument made after the second hearsay information came in?
No. By the time the third hearsay, which was essentially the element of the crime here, when he says that the motion sensors are going off, the trial court was aware that defense counsel was getting frustrated with what was allowed to be elicited. And it also, the record is also clear that at that point, defense counsel was really in a tough position because the trial court had already said, we're going to allow him to testify as to what he's doing there. regardless of the best practices. I'd like to, if the court has any questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Good morning. Excuse me while I raise the podium. May it please the court, James Wakely on behalf of the state of Delaware. Contrary to Mr. Sanabria's argument, there was evidence that he was in the house aside from the motion sensor going off. Lawrence DeSabatino, the owner of the home, came home when he received a call from his from the alarm company, found that the rear of the rear.
Wait, just a moment. Are you telling us this because it's part of a harmless error argument that you're making?
Part of it. I think the state's position is relatively clear on this is not hearsay, and I'll return to that. I just want to give the court a fuller context.
All right. Just it would help us in listening if you tell us why you're doing that.
Okay. Lawrence DeSabatino returned home, found that the rear of his home, the door, had been pried open, so damaging the door, in fact, that the lock had to be replaced. He found that despite the fact he's a nitpicky person, the things in his office had been moved, the phone had been removed from the wall, had been wrapped up with the cord and placed in another position. The computer had been taken from the floor and moved to another location. These were things that he knew where these objects were, where they were supposed to be, and they were no longer there. That evidence alone is sufficient to establish that someone other than someone authorized by him was in his home. He specifically said he didn't authorize anybody to be in his home that morning. Just so that the court's clear, I will acknowledge there are three statements referred to as hearsay at trial. For the court's purpose, the first is the statement of the dispatcher. We have a report of a Hispanic male seen behind the home of 7 Alders Lane. The second is the alarm is going off inside the home. And the third was objected to, but I don't believe was presented here, is Teresa Bracken, the nanny who was in 7 Alders Lane, called her employer to find out if there was some reason for someone to be going to the back of 9 Alders Lane. The first statement as to there's a Hispanic male in the back of the home, Teresa Bracken testified that that's what she saw. She was at trial. She testified to that. It was certainly relevant to explain why the police officer went to the home.
Right. Well, I don't want to interrupt the flow of your argument, but as I said earlier, it would be helpful to us if you told us why you give the explanation rather than give us the facts and then tell us at the end where you're heading. Now, based on what you just said, and my question is, what should the general rule be after Johnson? Should the policeman say, I responded based on a call from the dispatcher? Or should the policeman, as a general rule, say, I responded based on a call from the dispatcher, and this is what the dispatcher said. Now, I understand you're going to argue other witnesses confirmed what the dispatcher said, or that there may be independent evidence to demonstrate the person's in the house. But for the focus of this appeal, it appears to be, what content can you include as background when a hearsay statement's presented? So that's my question. Should you simply say, I responded to the call from the dispatcher, or should the general rule be the content of what the dispatcher said?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I apologize for being perhaps more disorganized than I should be. The Johnson was fairly clear that the general practice should be that the police officer should say, I responded to the location upon information received. However, that very court decided that the circumstances given by the police officer, the report that he received, was relevant to the discussion about and was admissible at trial. The police officer instituted a controlled drug buy. He was unable, from his own knowledge, to identify the individuals who were in the other vehicle and who had sold him the narcotics. When he later conferred with another officer and with a confidential informant, he gave the general description of these individuals. The confidential informant identified them specifically by name, and the officer and the rest of the police department then went out and arrested these individuals.
Mr. Wakely, I thought the question that Justice Holland asked was when alleged hearsay is introduced of the sort here, what should the rule be regarding the level of detail that's communicated to the jury?
Your Honor, I would suggest that the level of detail is what is necessary for the state to tell its story without unfairly prejudicing the defendant with out-of-court statements.
Well, let's look at it a different way, and let's characterize your answer to the that you just gave with regard to the first hearsay question to be consistent with Johnson. It appears that if the dispatcher gives a description, it's permissible to give the description by way of background. We'll just say hypothetically that we can make that connection.
Yes.
So let's go to the content of the other two. Or let's just go straight to the third. Under what theory was it permissible by way of background to say the alarm was going off in the foyer?
What happened when the police officer got there? He checked the rear door. He saw pry marks, but the door was secured. He went around to the front of the house. The front of the house door was secured. At that point, he receives a call. The alarm's going off. So he goes back around the back of the home because he's standing in front of the front door. He can see that the front door is secured and that no one has gotten past him.
Mr. Wakely,
yes.
when you're asked a legal question, it would be most helpful to us if you would give us a legal answer, not a factual one.
Yes, sir.
The legal question was under what theory, that is, under what legal theory, was the information that was communicated to the jury, hearsay information, admissible?
Your Honor, the state would argue it's not hearsay. The information was merely used to explain why the officer felt the need to go back around to the rear of the home.
All right, let's assume for a minute that there is a basis to offer that argument. What changes the argument if the information is also supplying an element of the charged offense that the state is unable to satisfy otherwise? How does a trial judge analyze it?
First, Your Honor, as I mentioned before,
evidence. You claim there's other evidence that there was someone inside, but what we're focused on right now is the jury hearing, for whatever reason, that sensors or an alarm went off inside the building, which clearly goes directly to an element of the alleged offense of burglary. So what kind of analysis should the trial judge perform at this point? Does the trial judge stop with the theory that it's not offered for its truth, it's simply offered for the purpose of showing why the police officer did a double take and went back to the back door for a second time?
No, Your Honor.
There's a huge missing gap there, isn't there? That's rather a simplistic way to analyze it. There has to be more.
Indeed, Your Honor. And Johnson,
hear me of the cynical view that the state wanted that in because they were concerned that the other evidence they had that someone was in the home was insufficient to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that there had been an actual home invasion. And without the sensor information conveyed by hearsay, they wouldn't have been able to establish that element. Cure me of that concern.
Your Honor, Johnson makes clear that the next step in the analysis is you're supposed to proceed to a 403 analysis. However, that was never requested here. The judge was never placed on notice that a 403 analysis was desired.
I mean, the judge, you don't assume the judge reads the case law?
Of course, Your Honor, I understand that the judge reads the case law. Johnson.
Why does the judge stop in the analysis at the argument that it was not really hearsay because it wasn't offered for the truth when it's like a 600-pound gorilla in the room supplying evidence of an element of the offense?
Your Honor, the argument that was presented at trial was never, this is the only evidence they have as to someone going into the home. This is hearsay, and that was the objection at trial. And the explanation is, well, we're using this to explain why he went around back. If this really was the only evidence that he was in the home, then it wouldn't pass the 403 test.
Well, let's assume for a minute there is other evidence. It's still substantial evidence, compelling evidence that there was someone in the home, isn't it?
It is true that it would be substantial evidence. However, it didn't point to Mr. Sanabria. It points at most that someone was in the home.
Well, so does your other evidence.
Indeed. Evidence.
Why the distinction?
Because the evidence in the other cases, and the reason I draw this distinction, the evidence in Johnson, Fullerton, Quayle.
No, I'm talking about your other evidence that someone was in the home in addition to the hearsay recitation or the arguably hearsay recitation of the alarms or sensors going off. You said that didn't point directly to the defendant here, but nor did any of the other evidence that someone had been in the home, did it?
Other than the fairly substantial circumstantial link of Teresa Bracken seeing Ramon Sanabria, identifying him at the scene and at trial, going to the back, and that was the only person within that relevant time period she saw do that.
There's a difference between breaking and entering and burglary, isn't there?
Yes.
All she saw was somebody at the back door that met the description that the dispatcher gave to the police officer. She didn't see him emerge from the building, correct?
She saw him go up to the deck the first time, look around, then leave, then come back to the rear of the home. Apparently the line of sight was not sufficient that she could see him specifically at the door trying to jimmy the door. But she did see him twice go to the rear of nine Alders Lane.
Well, in this case, you agree that if Johnson had been cited and applied, there would have been a 403 analysis.
Yes.
And the 403 analysis would have involved balancing, trying to explain what the officer did versus the prejudice to the defendant. So as I understand it, the state's position would be what the officer did in going back to the front door is so inexplicable and so beyond the pale of good police work. If we don't give them the background for this, the jury's never going to understand the state's case. We have to tell them why the officer was being this thorough. The defendant's going to say, well, if you tell them that the alarm went off in the foyer, it suggests someone's in the house. That's an element of the crime. And that significantly prejudices my case in the eyes of the jury. So how does the court resolve that or recharacterize the state's argument? Why was it so important for the jury to discharge its function from the state's point of view to let them know the alarm had gone off in the foyer?
With all due respect, it wasn't absolutely critical to explain the completely inexplicable behavior of the police officer. It was just part of it.
If that had been said to the trial judge, then the trial judge would say, okay, well, we're not going to tell the jury that. Yeah. Right?
Well, it was part of explaining the story, and it was a relatively minimal, from the state's perspective, it was a relatively minimal statement. The alarm's going off, so he went around back.
But as the Chief Justice pointed out, it's hard to say it's a relatively minimal statement when it's an element of the offense. Is that your position, that getting in this testimony that constitutes an element of the offense should be looked at by this court As a minimal statement?
No, but, Your Honor, if you go to the balancing test, if you go to the 403 balancing test, here it was, it would be balanced with, we have direct testimony that somebody was in the house, that this statement doesn't add to that, and it was Ramon Sanabria. What happened in these other cases were...
Well, then it's repetitive and totally unnecessary, because you had other evidence that there was someone in the house.
It was part of telling the story.
Well, look, it's either essential to the state's case to get it in for some valid reason, or it's immaterial and it's redundant and it's unnecessary. Now, which is it?
It was, looking at the scope of the whole transcript, it was likely cumulative of what was otherwise available to the jury.
So then it would have failed a 403 test?
In terms of was it unfairly prejudicial to him, the state would suggest not.
It was cumulative.
It was only minimally cumulative. It was explaining why the police officer, Your Honor, and I apologize.
Yeah, again, you're using the word minimum, and we keep suggesting to you, perhaps unnecessarily, that if it goes to an element of the offense, how is it minimal?
Your Honor, the state would suggest that any time, any of this evidence, that in any of these cases, goes to some element of the offense, otherwise it's not relevant.
Well, help me understand the chronology of the trial and events, because maybe I'm confused on both. I thought that at the trial, the police officer testified before the homeowner, and I thought the chronology of the events were that the police officer was on the scene before the homeowner returned and discovered items inside the house had been moved.
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I right on both?
Yes, you are.
So then, if we go back to the point of time in the trial, when the state wants to present evidence that the alarm in the foyer went off, there had been no testimony yet from the homeowner that anything in the house had been disturbed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when you say it's cumulative, that's a 2020 hindsight statement.
Yes, Your Honor. From the view looking back at the record, that is clearly just a hindsight recollection.
So, but my understanding of the chronology of the testimony and the events is correct.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. The officer, I believe, was either the first or second witness, and a DART bus operator was one of the other first few witnesses. Just returning to the Third Circuit cases that were cited by Mr. Sanabria.
Well, before you do that, Mr. Wakely, let me touch on one other issue. The argument that we're being presented with today is that there was error because the court did not exclude at least two out of the three alleged hearsay statements on 403 grounds, that is, on the grounds that their prejudicial effect outweighed whatever probative value they had. It also appears, however, that the court did not even rule, that is, did not engage in a 403 analysis. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the court wasn't asked to engage in a 403 analysis.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And after alleged hearsay testimony came in, there was no request for a curative instruction of any kind.
That's correct, Your Honor.
My question is, what is our standard of review? In the briefs, both sides appear to agree that the standard of review is abuse of discretion.
As to the question of hearsay, it is abuse of discretion. The state would suggest, as to the question of error in not giving the 403 balancing test, that would be plain error. Because it was never presented in that fashion, in any fashion, to the trial court. None of the cases cited by counsel were presented to the trial court.
Well, help us kind of parse the state's position and use of the statement. You say that this was background information and that it wasn't admitted for the truth of what was said. However, in looking at the record, isn't it necessary to have a limiting instruction for the state to accomplish that? Otherwise, we see the statement being admitted in an unqualified way. So the jury, in the absence of a limiting instruction, could use it for both purposes, background and substance, and that's why we give a limiting instruction.
Certainly, Your Honor, if a limiting instruction had been asked for, it would have been inappropriate to object to it, that this was only to be used to explain the officer's behavior. Such a limiting instruction would have been entirely appropriate.
Well, my question in a straightforward way is, in just looking at the hearsay argument, you say, I'd like this to come in by way of background. It comes in, but the jury is never told it's coming in for background. So how do we say it was properly admitted in a non-hearsay context when the jury was never told that?
Well, Your Honor, the jury was never told that it was for background, nor was it ever argued by the state that this was important evidence. At most, the only reference the state makes to this beyond these remarks in testimony was during rebuttal argument after defense counsel brings it up. And even then, it's the police officer receives a report that there's something going on in the house and returns behind the home. The only argument the state ever used this for was this is explaining why the police officer did what he did, not that this is substantive evidence that Ramon Sanabria was inside the house. If the court has no further questions.
No, and actually I didn't turn your timer on until you were well into your argument. So theoretically, you've had your day in court, if you don't mind me saying so.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if I may, I
just... My technical error.
I would like to lower the podium.
I'll be brief, Your Honors. To the effect that Johnson controls this case with respect to the background information that Justice Holland alluded to, certainly it's a tougher question with respect to the first hearsay that comes in, even though our position certainly is that it goes beyond. And as the statements come in, the picture gets clearer. By the time the third statement comes in about the element of the crime, which the Chief Justice refers as the 600-pound gorilla in the room, it's clear that we've gone beyond what Johnson allows. Secondly, the state's position that it was used for a non-hearsay purpose, well, let's look at the record. In the opening and the closing arguments, they used the motion in the foyer. If it was used for a non-hearsay purpose, why is it being used to the jury to discuss an element of the crime? And lastly, Justice Jacobs' question with respect to the plain error, we would submit that even under plain error, because that it meets the element of a crime, because the harm, whether or not a 403 analysis was done, because the effect was the element of the crime, it has affected the outcome of the trial.
Just one question. You're telling us that I forget which of the hearsay statements, whether it was one, two, or all three, were used by the state as evidence, that is, they were argued by the state at closing argument, as substantive evidence to satisfy one or more of the elements of the charge?
Yes. The motion in the foyer was discussed in the opening and the closing argument. So if it's used for a non-hearsay purpose, it's...
So Mr. Wakely's incorrect when he suggests to us that it's invited error because it was only brought up in the context of a discussion about an element of the offense, evidence that someone was actually in the home, in the defense closing argument, and then only mentioned by the prosecutor in rebuttal.
That's incorrect.
That's incorrect?
That's incorrect. Yeah, the opening, if the court would like the exact language of the opening, I'd be happy to quickly. I see I have about a minute left, so if the court can bear with me here. The opening, it's the prosecutor says, he'll tell you, referring to Officer Garcia, that he returned to the front of the door and checked the door after being told that the security system at the place there was movement, and there was movement in the foyer area. If the court has any questions, any more questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.